depends on value rigidity for its effectiveness. The trap consists of a hollowed-out coconut chained to a stake. The coconut has some rice inside, which can be grabbed through a small hole. The hole is big enough so that the monkey's hand can go in, but too small for his fist with rice in it to come out. The monkey reaches in and is suddenly trapped by nothing more than his own value rigidity. He can't revalue the rice. He cannot see that freedom without rice is more valuable than capture with it. The villagers are coming to get him and take him away. They're coming closer, closer. Now! What general advice, not specific advice, but what general advice would you give the poor monkey in circumstances like this? Well, I think you might say exactly what I've been saying about value rigidity, with perhaps a little extra urgency. There is a fact this monkey should know. If he opens his hand, he's free. But how is he going to discover this fact? By removing the value rigidity that rates rice above freedom. How is he going to do that? Well, he should somehow try to slow down deliberately and go over ground that he has been over before and see if things he thought were important really were important and, well, stop yanking and just stare at the coconut for a while. Before long, he should get a nibble from a little fact, wondering if he is interested in it. He should try to understand this fact not so much in terms of his big problem as for its own sake. That problem may not be as big as he thinks it is. That fact may not be as small as he thinks it is either. That's about all the general information you can give him. At Prairie City, we're out of the mountain forests again and into a dry land town with a wide main street that looks right down through the center of the town and onto the prairie beyond it. We try one restaurant, but it's closed. We go across the broad street and try another. The door is open, we sit down and order malted milks. While waiting, I get the outline of the letter Chris was preparing for his mother and give it to him. To my surprise, he works on it without many questions. I sit back in the booth and don't disturb him. I keep feeling that the facts I'm fishing for concerning Chris are right in front of me, too, but that some value rigidity of my own blocks me from seeing it. At times we seem to move in parallel rather than in combination, then at odd moments collide. His troubles at home always begin when he is imitating me, trying to command others the way I command him, particularly his younger brother. Naturally, the others aren't having any of his commands, and he can't see their right not to, and that's when all hell breaks loose. He can't seem to care whether he's popular with anyone else. He just wants to be popular with me. Not healthy at all, everything considered. It's about time for him to begin the long process of breaking away. That break should be as easy as possible, but it should be made. It's time to set him on his own feet. The sooner the better. And now, having thought all that, I don't believe it anymore. I don't know what the trouble is. That dream that keeps recurring haunts me because I can't escape its meaning. I'm forever on the other side of a glass door from him, which I don't open. He wants me to open it, and before I always turned away. But now there's a new figure who prevents me. Strange. After a while, Chris says he's tired of writing. We get up, I pay at the counter, and we leave. On the road now, and talking about traps again. The next one is important. It's the internal gumption trap of ego. Ego isn't entirely separate from value rigidity, but one of the many causes of it. If you have a high evaluation of yourself, then your ability to recognize new facts is weakened. Your ego isolates you from the quality reality. When the facts show that you've just goofed, you're not as likely to admit it. When false information makes you look good, you're likely to believe it. On any mechanical repair job, ego comes in for rough treatment. You're always being fooled, you're always making mistakes, and a mechanic who has a big ego to defend is at a terrific disadvantage. If you know enough mechanics to think of them as a group, and your observations coincide with mine, I think you'll agree that mechanics tend to be rather modest and quiet. There are exceptions, but generally if they're not quiet and modest at first, the work seems to make them that way. And skeptical. Attentive, but skeptical. But not egoistic. There's no way to bullshit your way into looking good on a mechanical repair job except with someone who doesn't know what you're doing. I was going to say that the machine doesn't respond to your personality, but it does respond to your personality. It's just that the personality that it responds to is your real personality, the one that genuinely feels and reasons and acts, rather than any false, blown-up personality images your ego may conjure up. These false images are deflated so rapidly and completely, you're bound to be very discouraged very soon, if you've derived your gumption from ego rather than quality. If modesty doesn't come easily or naturally to you, one way out of this trap is to fake the attitude of modesty anyway. If you just deliberately assume you're not much good, then your gumption gets a boost when the facts prove this assumption is correct. This way, you can keep going until the time comes when the facts prove this assumption is incorrect. Anxiety, the next gumption trap, is sort of the opposite of ego. You're so sure you'll do everything wrong, you're afraid to do anything at all. Often this, rather than laziness, is the real reason you find it hard to get started. This gumption trap of anxiety, which results from overmotivation, can lead to all kinds of errors of excessive fussiness. You fix things that don't need fixing, and chase after imaginary ailments. You jump to wild conclusions and build all kinds of errors into the machine because of your own nervousness. These errors, when made, tend to confirm your original underestimation of yourself. This leads to more errors, which lead to more underestimation, in a self-stoking cycle. The best way to break this cycle, I think, is to work out your anxieties on paper. Read every book and magazine you can on the subject. Your anxiety makes this easy, and the more you read, the more you calm down. You should remember that it's peace of mind you're after, and not just a fixed machine. When beginning a repair job, you can list everything you're going to do on little slips of paper, which you then organize into proper sequence. You discover that you organize and then reorganize the sequence again and again as more and more ideas come to you. The time spent this way usually more than pays for itself in time saved in the machine, and prevents you from doing fidgety things that create problems later on. You can reduce your anxiety somewhat by facing the fact that there isn't a mechanic alive who doesn't louse up a job once in a while. The main difference between you and the commercial mechanics is that when they do it, you don't hear about it. Just pay for it in additional costs prorated through all your bills. When you make the mistakes yourself, you at least get the benefit of some education. Boredom is the next gumption trap that comes to mind. This is the opposite of anxiety and commonly goes with ego problems. Boredom means you're off the quality track, you're not seeing things freshly, you've lost your beginner's mind, and your motorcycle is in great danger. Boredom means your gumption supply is low and must be replenished before anything else is done. When you're bored, stop. Go to a show. Turn on the TV. Call it a day. Do anything but work on that machine. If you don't stop, the next thing that happens is the big mistake. And then all the boredom plus the big mistake combined together in one Sunday punch to knock all the gumption out of you, and you are really stopped. My favorite cure for boredom is sleep. It's very easy to get to sleep when bored, and very hard to get bored after a long rest. My next favorite is coffee. I usually keep a pot plugged in while working on the machine. If these don't work, it may mean deeper quality problems are bothering you and distracting you from what's before you. The boredom is a signal that you should turn your attention to these problems. That's what you're doing anyway. And control them before continuing on the motorcycle. For me, the most boring task is cleaning the machine. It seems like such a waste of time. It just gets dirty again the first time you ride it. John always kept his BMW spick and span. It really did look nice, while mine's always a little ratty, it seems. That's the classical mind at work. Runs fine inside, but looks dingy on the surface. One solution to boredom on certain kinds of jobs, such as greasing and oil changing and tuning, is to turn them into a kind of ritual. There's an aesthetic to doing things that are unfamiliar, and another aesthetic to doing things that are familiar. I have heard that there are two kinds of welders. Production welders, who don't like tricky setups and enjoy doing the same thing over and over again. And maintenance welders, who hate it when they have to do the same job twice. The advice was that if you hire a welder, make sure which kind he is, because they're not interchangeable. I'm in that latter class, and it's probably why I enjoy troubleshooting more than most and dislike cleaning more than most. But I can do both when I have to, and so can anyone else. When cleaning, I do it the way most people go to church. Not so much to discover anything new, although I'm alert for new things, but mainly to reacquaint myself with the familiar. It's nice sometimes to go over familiar paths. Zen has something to say about boredom. Its main practice of just sitting has got to be the world's most boring activity. Unless it's that Hindu practice of being buried alive. You don't do anything much. Not move, not think, not care. What could be more boring? Yet in the center of all this boredom is the very thing Zen Buddhism seeks to teach. What is it? What is it at the very center of boredom that you're not seeing? Impatience is close to boredom, but always results from one cause: an underestimation of the amount of time the job will take. You never really know what will come up, and very few jobs get done as quickly as planned. Impatience is the first reaction against a setback, and can soon turn to anger if you're not careful. Impatience is best handled by allowing an indefinite time for the job, particularly new jobs that require unfamiliar techniques, by doubling the allotted time when circumstances force time planning, and by scaling down the scope of what you want to do. Overall goals must be scaled down in importance, and immediate goals must be scaled up. This requires value flexibility, and the value shift is usually accompanied by some loss of gumption, but it's a sacrifice that must be made. It's nothing like the loss of gumption that will occur if a big mistake caused by impatience occurs. My favorite scaling down exercise is cleaning up nuts and bolts and studs and tapped holes. I've got a phobia about crossed or jimmied or rust-jammed or dirt-jammed threads that cause nuts to turn slow or hard. And when I find one, I take its dimensions with a thread gauge and calipers, get out the taps and dies, recut the threads on it, then examine it and oil it, and I have a whole new perspective on patience. Another one is cleaning up tools that have been used and not put away and are cluttering up the place. This is a good one because one of the first warning signs of impatience is frustration at not being able to lay your hand on the tool you need right away. If you just stop and put the tools away neatly, you will both find the tool and also scale down your impatience without wasting time or endangering the work. We're pulling into Dayville, and my rear end feels like it's turned to concrete. Well, that about does it for value traps. There's a whole lot more of them, of course. I've really only just touched on the subject to show what's there. Almost any mechanic could fill you in for hours on value traps he's discovered that I don't know anything about. You're bound to discover plenty of them for yourself on almost every job. Perhaps the best single thing to learn is to recognize a value trap when you're in it and work on that before you continue on the machine. Dayville has huge shade trees by the filling station where we wait for the attendant to appear. None does, and we, being stiff and uneager to get back on the cycle, do leg exercises under the shade of the trees. Big trees that almost completely cover the road. Odd in this desert-like country. The attendant still doesn't show, but his competitor at the filling station across the narrow intersection is watching this, and soon comes over to fill the tank. "I don't know where John is," he says. When John appears, he thanks the other attendant and says proudly, "We always help each other out like this." I ask him if there's a place to rest, and he says, "You can use my front lawn." He points across the main road to his house behind some cottonwood trees that must be 3 or 4 feet in diameter. We do this, stretch out on some long green grass, and I see that the grass and trees are irrigated from a ditch by the road that has clear moving water in it. We must have slept half an hour when we see John is in a rocking chair on the green grass beside us, talking to a fire warden in another chair. I listen. The conversation's pace intrigues me. It isn't intended to go anywhere, just fill the time of day. I haven't heard steady, slow-paced conversation like that since the 30s, when my grandfather and great-grandfather and uncles and great-uncles used to talk like that. on and on, with no point or purpose other than to fill time. Like the rocking of a chair. John sees I'm awake, and we talk a little. He says the irrigation water comes from the Chinaman's ditch. You never could get a white man to dig a ditch like that, he says. They dug that ditch 80 years ago when they thought there was gold here. You couldn't get a ditch like that anywhere nowadays. He says that's why the trees are so big. We talk some about where we're from and where we're going, and when we leave, John says he's happy to have met us and hopes we're rested. As we move off under the big trees, Chris waves, and he smiles and waves back. The desert road winds through rocky gorges and hills. This is the driest country yet. I want to talk now about truth traps and muscle traps, and then stop this Chautauqua for today. Truth traps are concerned with data that are apprehended and are within the boxcars of the train. For the most part, these data are properly handled by conventional dualistic logic and the scientific method talked about earlier, back just after Mile City. But there's one trap that isn't. The truth trap of yes-no logic. Yes and no, this or that, one or zero. On the basis of this elementary two-term discrimination, all human knowledge is built up. The demonstration of this is the computer memory which stores all knowledge in the form of binary information. It contains ones and zeros, that's all. Because we're unaccustomed to it, we don't usually see that there's a third possible logical term, equal to yes and no, which is capable of explaining our understanding in an unrecognized direction. We don't even have a term for it, so I'll have to use the Japanese mu. Mu means no thing. Like quality, it points outside the process of dualistic discrimination. Mu simply says, no class, not one, not zero, not yes, not no. It states that the context of the question is such that a yes or no answer is an error and should not be given. Unask the question is what it says. Mu becomes appropriate when the context of the question becomes too small for the truth of the answer. When the Zen monk Joshu was asked whether a dog had a Buddha nature, he said mu, meaning that if he answered either way, he was answering incorrectly. The Buddha nature cannot be captured by yes or no questions. That mu exists in the natural world investigated by science is evident. It's just that, as usual, we're trained not to see it by our heritage. For example, it's stated over and over again that computer circuits exhibit only two states, a voltage for one and a voltage for zero. That's silly. Any computer electronics technician knows otherwise. Try to find a voltage representing one or zero when the power is off. The circuits are in a mu state. They aren't at one, they aren't at zero. They're in an indeterminate state that has no meaning in terms of ones or zeros. Readings of the voltmeter will show, in many cases, floating ground characteristics, in which the technician isn't reading characteristics of the computer circuits at all, but characteristics of the voltmeter itself. What's happened is that the power-off condition is part of a context larger than the context in which the 1-0 states are considered universal. The question of 1 or 0 has been unasked. And there are plenty of other computer conditions besides the power-off condition in which mu answers are found because of larger contexts than the 1-0 universality. The dualistic mind tends to think of mu occurrences in nature as a kind of contextual cheating or irrelevance. But mu is found throughout all scientific investigation, and nature doesn't cheat, and nature's answers are never irrelevant. It's a great mistake, a kind of dishonesty, to sweep nature's mu answers under the carpet. Recognition and valuation of these answers would do a lot to bring logical theory closer to experimental practice. Every laboratory scientist knows that very often his experimental results provide mu answers to the yes-no questions the experiments were designed for. In these cases, he considers the experiment poorly designed, chides himself for stupidity, and at best considers the wasted experiment, which has provided the Moo answer, to be a kind of wheel spinning, which might help prevent mistakes in the design of future yes-no experiments. This low evaluation of the experiment, which provided the Moo answer, isn't justified. The Moo answer is an important one. It's told the scientist that the context of his question is too small for nature's answer, and that he must enlarge the context of the question. That is a very important answer. His understanding of nature is tremendously improved by it, which was the purpose of the experiment in the first place. A very strong case can be made for the statement that science grows by its Moo answers more than by its yes or no answers. Yes or no confirms or denies a hypothesis. Moo says the answer is beyond the hypothesis. Moo is the phenomenon that inspires scientific inquiry in the first place. There's nothing mysterious or esoteric about it. It's just that our culture has warped us to make a low-value judgment of it. In motorcycle maintenance, the Moo answer given by the machine to many of the diagnostic questions put to it is a major cause of gumption loss. It shouldn't be. When your answer to a test is indeterminate, it means one of two things: that your test procedures aren't doing what you think they are, or that your understanding of the context of the question needs to be enlarged. Check your tests and restudy the question. Don't throw away those Moo answers. They're every bit as vital as the yes or no answers. They're more vital. They're the ones you grow on. This motorcycle seems to be running a little hot, but I suppose it's just the hot, dry country we're going through. I'll leave the answer to that in a Moo state until it gets worse or better. We stop for a long chocolate malted in the town of Mitchell, nestled in some dry hills that we can see out the plate glass window. Some kids come in on a truck and stop and all pile off and come into the restaurant and sort of dominate it. They're reasonably well-behaved, just noisy and energetic, but you can see the lady who's running it is a little nervous about them. Dry desert, sandy country again. Into it we go. It's late afternoon now, and we've really covered the miles. I'm getting quite sore from sitting all this time on the cycle, and feeling really tired now. So was Chris back at the restaurant. A little despondent, too. I think maybe he... Well, let it go. The Moo expansion is the only thing I want to say about truth traps at this time. Time to switch to the psychomotor traps. This is the domain of understanding which is most directly related to what happens to the machine. Here, by far, the most frustrating gumption trap is inadequate tools. Nothing's quite so demoralizing as a tool hang-up. Buy good tools as you can afford them, and you'll never regret it. If you want to save money, don't overlook the newspaper want ads. Good tools, as a rule, don't wear out, and good second-hand tools are much better than inferior new ones. Study the tool catalogs. You can learn a lot from them. Apart from bad tools, bad surroundings are a major gumption trap. Pay attention to adequate lighting. It's amazing the number of mistakes a little light can prevent. Some physical discomfort is unpreventable, but a lot of it, such as that which occurs in surroundings that are too hot or too cold, can throw your evaluations way off if you aren't careful. If you're too cold, for example, you'll hurry and probably make mistakes. If you're too hot, your anger threshold gets much lower. Avoid out-of-position work when possible. A small stool on either side of the cycle will increase your patience greatly, and you'll be much less likely to damage the assemblies you're working on. There's one psychomotor gumption trap, muscular insensitivity, which accounts for some real damage. It results in part from lack of kinesthesia, a failure to realize that although the externals of a cycle are rugged, inside the engine are delicate precision parts which can be easily damaged by muscular insensitivity. There's what's called mechanics feel, which is very obvious to those who know what it is, but hard to describe to those who don't. And when you see someone working on a machine who doesn't have it, you tend to suffer with the machine. The mechanics feel comes from a deep, inner, kinesthetic feeling for the elasticity of materials. Some materials, like ceramics, have very little, so that when you thread a porcelain fitting, you're very careful not to apply great pressures. Other materials, like steel, have tremendous elasticity, more than rubber, but in a range in which, unless you're working with large mechanical forces, the elasticity isn't apparent. With nuts and bolts, you're in the range of large mechanical forces, and you should understand that within these ranges, metals are elastic. When you take up a nut, there's a point called finger tight, where there's contact, but no take-up of elasticity. Then there's snug, in which the easy surface elasticity is taken up. Then there's a range called tight, in which all the elasticity is taken up. The force required to reach these three points is different for each size of nut and bolt, and different for lubricated bolts and for lock nuts. The forces are different for steel, and cast iron, and brass, and aluminum, and plastics, and ceramics. But a person with mechanics feel knows when something's tight and stops. A person without it goes right on past and strips the threads or breaks the assembly. A mechanics feel implies not only an understanding for the elasticity of metal, but for its softness. The insides of a motorcycle contain surfaces that are precise, in some cases, to as little as 1/10,000th of an inch. If you drop them, or get dirt on them, or scratch them, or bang them with a hammer, they'll lose that precision. It's important to understand that the metal behind the surfaces can normally take great shock and stress, but that the surfaces themselves cannot. When handling precision parts that are stuck or difficult to manipulate, a person with mechanics feel will avoid damaging the surfaces and work with his tools on the non-precision surfaces of the same part whenever possible. If he must work on the surfaces themselves, he'll always use softer surfaces to work them with. Brass hammers, plastic hammers, wood hammers, rubber hammers, and lead hammers are all available for this work. Use them. Vise jaws can be fitted with plastic and copper and lead faces. Use these too. Handle precision parts gently. You'll never be sorry. If you have a tendency to bang things around, take more time and try to develop a little more respect for the accomplishment that a precision part represents. Low-angled shadows in the dry country we've been through have left a kind of blue, depressed feeling. Maybe it's just the usual late-afternoon letdown, but after all I've said about all these things today, I just have a feeling that I've somehow talked around the point. Some could ask, well, if I get around all those gumption traps, then will I have the thing licked? The answer, of course, is no, you still haven't got anything licked. You've got to live right, too. It's the way you live that predisposes you to avoid the traps and see the right facts. You want to know how to paint a perfect painting? It's easy. Make yourself perfect, and then just paint naturally. That's the way all the experts do it. The making of a painting or the fixing of a motorcycle isn't separate from the rest of your existence. If you're a sloppy thinker, the 6 days of the week you aren't working on your machine, what trap avoidances, what gimmicks can make you all of a sudden sharp on the seventh? It all goes together. But if you're a sloppy thinker 6 days a week, and you really try to be sharp on the seventh, then maybe the next 6 days aren't going to be quite as sloppy as the preceding six. What I'm trying to come up with on these gumption traps, I guess, is shortcuts to living right. The real cycle you're working on is a cycle called yourself. The machine that appears to be out there and the person that appears to be in here are not two separate things. They grow toward quality or fall away from quality together. We arrive in Prineville Junction with only a few hours of daylight left. We're at the intersection with Highway 97, where we'll turn south, and I fill up the tank at the corner, and then I'm so tired I go around and back and sit on the yellow-painted cement curb with my feet in the gravel, and the last rays of the sun flaring through the trees into my eyes. Chris comes and sits down too, and we don't say anything. But this is the worst depression yet. All that talk about gumption traps, and I fall right into one myself. Fatigue, maybe. We've got to get some sleep. I watch the cars go by for a while on the highway. Something lonely about them. Not lonely. Worse. Nothing. Like the attendant's expression when he filled the tank. Nothing. A nothing curb by some nothing gravel at a nothing intersection going nowhere. Something about the car drivers, too. They look just like the gasoline attendant. staring straight ahead in some private trance of their own. I haven't seen that since Sylvia noticed it the first day. They all look like they're in a funeral procession. Once in a while, one gives a quick glance and then looks away expressionlessly, as if minding his own business, as if embarrassed that we might have noticed he was looking at us. I see it now because we've been away from it for a long time. The driving is different, too. The cars seem to be moving at a steady maximum speed for in-town driving, as though they want to get somewhere, as though what's here right now is just something to get through. The drivers seem to be thinking about where they want to be, rather than where they are. I know what it is. We've arrived at the West Coast. We're all strangers again. Folks, I just forgot the biggest gumption trap of all. The funeral procession. The one everybody's in. This hyped-up, fuck-you, super-modern, ego style of life that thinks it owns this country. We've been out of it for so long, I'd forgotten all about it. We get into the stream of traffic going south, and I can feel the hyped-up danger close in. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 9, Side 1. We get into the stream of traffic going south, and I can feel the hyped-up danger close in. I see in the mirror some bastard is tailgating me and won't pass. I move it up to 75, and he still hangs in there. 95, and we pull away from him. I don't like this at all. At Bend, we stop and have supper in a modern restaurant in which people also come and go without looking at each other. The service is excellent, but impersonal. Farther south, we find a forest of scrubby trees subdivided into ridiculous little lots. Some developer's scheme, apparently. At one of the lots, far off the main highway, we spread out our sleeping bags and discover that the pine needles just barely cover what must be many feet of soft, spongy dust. I've never seen anything like it. We have to be careful not to pick up the needles, or the dust flies up over everything. We spread out the tarps and put the sleeping bags on them. That seems to work. Chris and I talk for a while about where we are and where we are going. I look at the map in the twilight, and then look at it some more with the flashlight. We've covered 325 miles today. That's a lot. Chris seems as completely tired as I am, and as ready as I am to fall asleep. Part 4, Chapter 27. Why don't you come out of the shadows? What do you really look like? You're afraid of something, aren't you? What is it you're afraid of? Beyond the figure in the shadows is the glass door. Chris is behind it, motioning me to open it. He's older now, but his face still has a pleading expression. What do I do now? He wants to know. What do I do next? He's waiting for my instructions. It's time to act. I study the figure in the shadows. It's not as omnipotent as it once seemed. Who are you? I ask. No answer. By what right is that door closed? Still no answer. The figure is silent, but it is also cowering. It's afraid. Of me. There are worse things than hiding in the shadows. Is that it? Is that why you don't speak? It seems to be quivering, retreating, as though sensing what I am about to do. I wait and then move closer to it. Loathsome, dark, evil thing. Closer. Looking not at it, but at the glass door, so as not to warn it. I pause again, brace myself, and then lunge. My hands sink into something soft where its neck should be. It writhes, and I tighten the grip as one holds a serpent. And now holding it tighter and tighter, we'll get it into the light. Here it comes. Now we'll see its face. Dad! Dad! I hear Chris's voice through the door. Yes, the first time. Dad! 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 Chris tugs at my shirt. Dad! Wake up! Dad! He's crying, sobbing now. Stop, Dad! Wake up! It's all right, Chris.
Dad, wake up!
I'm awake. I can just barely make out his face in the dawn light. We're in trees somewhere outside. There's a motorcycle here. I think we're in Oregon somewhere. I'm all right. It was just a nightmare. He continues to cry, and I sit quietly with him for a while. It's all right, I say, but he doesn't stop. He's badly frightened. So am I.
What were you dreaming about?
I was trying to see someone's face.
You shouted you were going to kill me.
No, not you.
Who?
The person in the dream.
Who was it?
I'm not sure. Chris's crying stops, but he continues to shake from the cold.
Did you see the face?
Yes.
What did it look like?
It was my own face, Chris. That's when I shouted. It was just a bad dream. I tell him he's shivering and should get back into the sleeping bag. He does this.
It's so cold, he says.
Yes. By the dawn light, I can see the vapor from our breaths. Then he crawls under the cover of the sleeping bag, and I can see only my own. I don't sleep. The dreamer isn't me at all. It's Phaedrus. He's waking up. A mind divided against itself. Me. I'm the evil figure in the shadows. I'm the loathsome one. I always knew he would come back. It's a matter now of preparing for it. The sky under the trees looks so gray and so hopeless. Poor Chris. Chapter 28. The despair grows now. Like one of those movie dissolves in which you know you're not in the real world, but it seems that way anyway. It's a cold, snowless November day. The wind blows dirt through the cracks of the windows of an old car with soot on the windows, and Chris, 6, sits beside him with sweaters on because the heater doesn't work, and through the dirty windows of the wind-blown car, they see that they move forward toward a gray, snowless sky between walls of gray and grayish-brown buildings with brick fronts, with broken glass between the brick fronts, and debris in the streets.
Where are we?
Chris says, and Phaedrus says, I don't know. And he really doesn't. His mind is all but gone. He is lost, drifting through the gray streets. Where are we going? Says Phaedrus.
To the bunk bedders, says Chris.
Where are they? Asks Phaedrus.
I don't know, says Chris. Maybe if we just keep going, we'll see them.
And so the two drive and drive through the endless streets, looking for the bunk bedders. Phaedrus wants to stop and put his head on the steering wheel and just rest. The soot and the gray have penetrated his eyes, and all but blotted cognizance from his brain. One street sign is like another. One gray-brown building is like the next. On and on they drive, looking for the bunk bedders. But the bunk bedders, Phaedrus knows, he will never find. Chris begins to realize slowly and by degrees that something is strange, that the person guiding the car is no longer really guiding it, that the captain is dead, and the car is pilotless. And he doesn't know this, but only feels it, and says, stop, and Phaedrus stops. A car behind honks, but Phaedrus does not move. Other cars honk, and then others, and Chris in panic says, go! And Phaedrus slowly, with agony, pushes his foot on the clutch and puts the car in gear. Slowly, in dream motion, the car moves in low through the streets.
Where do we live?
Phaedrus asks a frightened Chris. Chris remembers an address, but doesn't know how to get there, but reasons that if he asks enough people, he will find the way, and so says, stop the car, and gets out and asks directions, and leads a demented Phaedrus through the endless walls of brick and broken glass. Hours later, they arrive, and the mother is furious that they are so late. She cannot understand why they have not found the bunk bedders. Chris says, "We looked everywhere," but looks at Phaedrus with a quick glance of fright, of terror at something unknown. That, for Chris, is where it started. It won't happen again. I think what I'll do is head down for San Francisco and put Chris on a bus for home, and then sell the cycle and check in at a hospital. Or that last seems so pointless, I don't know what I'll do. The trip won't have been entirely wasted. At least he'll have some good memories of me as he grows up. That takes away some of the anxiety a little. That's a good thought to hold on to. I'll hold on to that. Meanwhile, just continue on a normal trip and hope something improves. Don't throw anything away. Never, never throw anything away. Cold out. Feels like winter. Where are we, that it should get this cold? We must be at a high altitude. I look out of the sleeping bag and this time see frost on the motorcycle. On the chrome of the gas tank, it's sparkling in the early sunlight. On the black frame, where the sunlight hits it, it's partly turned to beads of water that will soon run down the wheel. It's too cold to lie around. I remember the dust under the pine needles and put my boots on carefully to avoid stirring it up. At the motorcycle, I unpack everything, get out the long underwear and put it on, then clothes, then sweater, then jacket. I'm still cold. I step through the spongy dust onto the dirt road that has brought us here and sprint down it through the pines for 100 feet or so, then settle down to an even run, and finally stop. That feels better. Not a sound. The frost is in little patches on the road, too, but melting and dark wet tan between the patches where the early sun's rays strike it. It's so white and lacy and untouched. It's on the trees, too. I walk back softly down the road, as if not to disturb the sunrise. Early autumn feeling. Chris is still asleep, and we won't be able to go anywhere until the air warms up. Good time to get the cycle tuned. I work loose the knob on the side cover over the air filter, and underneath the filter withdraw a worn and dirty roll of field tools. My hands are stiff with the cold, and the backs of them are wrinkled. Those wrinkles aren't from the cold, though. At 40, that's old age coming on. I lay the roll on the seat and spread it open. There they are. Like seeing old friends again. I hear Chris, glance over the seat, and see that he's stirring, but doesn't get up. He's evidently just rolling in his sleep. After a while, the sun gets warmer, and my hands aren't as stiff as they were. I was going to talk about some of the lore of cycle repair, the hundreds of things you learn as you go along, which enrich what you're doing not only practically, but aesthetically. But that seems too trivial now, though I shouldn't say that. But now I want to shift into another direction, which completes his story. I never really completed it because I didn't think it would be necessary. But now I think it would be a good time to do that, in what time remains. The metal of these wrenches is so cold it hurts the hands. But it's a good hurt. It's real, not imaginary. And it's here, absolutely, in my hand. When you travel a path and note that another path breaks away to one side at, say, a 30-degree angle, and then later another path branches away to the same side at a broader angle, say 45 degrees, and another path later at 90 degrees, you begin to understand that there's some point over there that all the paths lead to, and that a lot of people have found it worthwhile to go that way. And you begin to wonder, out of curiosity, if perhaps that isn't the way you should go, too. In his pursuit of a concept of quality, Phaedrus kept seeing again and again little paths all leading toward some point off to one side. He thought he already knew about the general area they led to, ancient Greece, but now he wondered if he had overlooked something there. He had asked Sarah, who long before had come by with her watering pot and put the idea of quality in his head, where in English literature quality, as a subject, was taught.
Good heavens, I don't know. I'm not an English scholar, she had said. I'm a classics scholar. My field is Greek.
Is quality a part of Greek thought? He had asked.
Quality is every part of Greek thought, she had said,
and he had thought about this. Sometimes, under her old ladyish way of speaking, he thought he detected a secret canniness. As though, like a Delphic oracle, she said things with hidden meanings, but he could never be sure. Ancient Greece. Strange that for them quality should be everything, while today it sounds odd to even say quality is real. What unseen changes could have taken place? A second path to ancient Greece was indicated by the sudden way the whole question, what is quality, had been jolted into systematic philosophy. He had thought he was done with that field, but quality had opened it all up again. Systematic philosophy is Greek. The ancient Greeks invented it, and in so doing, put their permanent stamp on it. Whitehead's statement that all philosophy is nothing but footnotes to Plato can be well supported. The confusion about the reality of quality had to start back there sometime. A third path appeared when he decided to move on from Bozeman toward the PhD degree he needed to continue university teaching. He wanted to pursue the inquiry into the meaning of quality that his English teaching had started. But where? And in which discipline? It was apparent that the term quality was not within any one discipline, unless that discipline was philosophy. And he knew from his experience with philosophy that further study there was unlikely to uncover anything concerning an apparently mystic term in English composition. He became more and more aware of the possibility that there was no program available where he might study quality in terms resembling those in which he understood it. Quality lay not only outside any academic discipline, it lay outside the grasp of the methods of the entire Church of Reason. It would take quite a university to accept a doctoral thesis in which the candidate refused to define his central term. He looked through the catalogs for a long time before he discovered what he hoped he was looking for. There was one university, the University of Chicago, where there existed an interdisciplinary program in analysis of ideas and study of methods. The examining committee included a professor of English, a professor of philosophy, a professor of Chinese, and the chairman, who was a professor of ancient Greek. That one rang bells. On the machine now, everything is done except the oil change. I wake Chris, and we pack and go. He's still sleepy, but the cold air on the road wakes him up. The piney road goes upward, and there's not so much traffic this morning. The rocks among the pines are dark and volcanic. I wonder if that was volcanic dust we slept in. Is there such a thing as volcanic dust? Chris says he's hungry, and I am too. At the pine we stop. I tell Chris to order me ham and eggs for breakfast while I stay outside to change the oil. At a filling station next to the restaurant, I pick up a quart of oil, and in a gravelly lot back of the restaurant, remove the drain plug, let the oil drain, replace the plug, add the new oil, and when I'm done, the new oil on the dipstick shines in the sunlight almost as clear and colorless as water. Ah. I repack the wrench, enter the restaurant, and see Chris, and, on the table, my breakfast. I head into the washroom, clean up, and return. Am I hungry, he says. It was a cold night, I say. We burned up a lot of food just staying alive. The eggs are good. The ham, too. Chris talks about the dream and how it frightened him. And then that's done with. He looks as though he's about to ask a question, then doesn't. Then stares at the window into the pines for a while, then comes back with it. Dad?
What?
Why are we doing this?
What?
Just riding all the time.
Just to see the country. Vacation.
The answer doesn't seem to satisfy him. But he can't seem to say what's wrong with it. A sudden despair wave hits. Like that at dawn. I lie to him. That's what's wrong.
We just keep going and going, he says.
Sure. What would you rather do?
He has no answer. I don't either. On the road, an answer comes that we're doing the highest quality thing I can think of right now, but that wouldn't satisfy him any more than what I told him. I don't know what else I could have said. Sooner or later, before we say goodbye, if that's how it goes, we'll have to do some talking. Shielding him like this from the past may be doing him more harm than good. He'll have to hear about Phaedrus, although there's much he can never know, particularly the end. Phaedrus arrived at the University of Chicago, already in a world of thought so different from the one you or I understand, it would be difficult to relate, even if I fully remembered everything. I know that the acting chairman admitted him during the chairman's absence, on the basis of his teaching experience and apparent ability to converse intelligently. What he actually said is lost. Afterward, he waited for a number of weeks for the chairman to return in hopes of obtaining a scholarship. But when the chairman did appear, an interview took place, which consisted essentially of one question and no answer. The chairman said, "What is your substantive field?" Phaedrus said, "English composition." The chairman bellowed, "That is a methodological field." And for all practical purposes, that was the end of the interview. After some inconsequential conversation, Phaedrus stumbled, hesitated, and excused himself, then went back to the mountains. This was the characteristic of him that had failed him out of the university before. He had gotten stuck on a question and hadn't been able to think about anything else while the classes moved on without him. This time, however, he had all summer to think about why his field should be substantive or methodological, and all that summer, that is what he did. In the forests near the timberline, he ate Swiss cheese, slept on pine bough beds, drank mountain stream water, and thought about quality and substantive and methodological fields. Substance doesn't change. Method contains no permanence. Substance relates to the form of the atom. Method relates to what the atom does. In technical composition, a similar distinction exists between physical description and functional description. A complex assembly is best described first in terms of its substances, its sub-assemblies and parts. Then, next, it is described in terms of its methods, its functions as they occur in sequence. If you confuse physical and functional description, substance and method, you get all tangled up, and so does the reader. But to apply these classifications to a whole field of knowledge, such as English composition, seemed arbitrary and impractical. No academic discipline is without both substantive and methodological aspects. And quality had no connection, that he could see, with either one of them. Quality isn't a substance, neither is it a method. It's outside of both. If one builds a house using the plumb line and spirit level methods, he does so because a straight vertical wall is less likely to collapse, and thus has higher quality than a crooked one. Quality isn't method. It's the goal toward which method is aimed. Substance and substantive really corresponded to object and objectivity, which he'd rejected in order to arrive at a non-dualistic concept of quality. When everything is divided up into substance and method, just as when everything is divided up into subject and object, there's really no room for quality at all. His thesis could not be a part of a substantive field, because to accept a split into substantive and methodological was to deny the existence of quality. If quality was going to stay, the concept of substance and method would have to go. That would mean a quarrel with the committee, something he had no desire for at all. But he was angry that they should destroy the entire meaning of what he was saying with the very first question. Substantive field? What kind of Procrustean bed were they trying to shove him into, he wondered. He decided to examine more closely the background of the committee and did some library digging for this purpose. He felt this committee was off into some entirely alien pattern of thought. He didn't see where this pattern and the large pattern of his own thought joined together. He was especially disturbed by the quality of the explanations of the committee's purpose. They seemed extremely confusing. The entire description of the committee's work was a strange pattern of ordinary enough words put together in a most unordinary way,
so that the explanation seemed far more complex than the thing he was trying to have explained. This wasn't the bells ringing he'd heard before. He studied everything he could find that the chairman had written, and here again was found the strange pattern of language seen in the confusing description of the committee. It was a puzzling style because it was completely different from what he'd seen of the chairman himself. The chairman, in a brief interview, had impressed him with great quickness of mind and an equally swift temper. And yet here was one of the most ambiguous, inscrutable styles Phaedrus had ever read. Here were encyclopedic sentences that left subject and predicate completely out of shouting distance. Parenthetic elements were unexplainably inserted inside other parenthetic elements, equally unexplainably inserted into sentences whose relevance to the preceding sentences in the reader's mind was dead and buried and decayed long before the arrival of the period. But more remarkable of all was the wondrous and unexplained proliferations of abstract categories that seemed freighted with special meanings that never got stated, and whose content could only be guessed at. These piled one after another so fast and so close that Phaedrus knew he had no possible way of understanding what was before him, much less take issue with it. At first, Phaedrus presumed the reason for the difficulty was that all this was over his head. The articles assumed a certain basic learning which he didn't have. Then, however, he noticed that some of the articles were written for audiences that couldn't possibly have this background, and this hypothesis was weakened. His second hypothesis was that the chairman was a technician, a phrase he used for a writer so deeply involved in his field that he'd lost the ability to communicate with people outside. But if this were so, why was the committee given such a general, non-technical title as Analysis of Ideas and Study of Methods? And the chairman didn't have the personality of a technician. So that hypothesis was weak, too. In time, Phaedrus abandoned the labor of pounding his head against the chairman's rhetoric and tried to discover more about the background of the committee, hoping that would explain what this was all about. This, it turned out, was the correct approach. He began to see what his trouble was. The chairman's statements were guarded, guarded by enormous, labyrinthine fortifications that went on and on with such complexity and massiveness, it was almost impossible to discover what in the world it was inside them he was guarding. The inscrutability of all this was the kind of inscrutability you have when you suddenly enter a room where a furious argument has just ended. Everyone is quiet. No one is talking. I have one tiny fragment of Phaedrus standing in the stone corridor of a building, evidently within the University of Chicago, addressing the assistant chairman of the committee, like a detective at the end of a movie, saying, "In your description of the committee, you have omitted one important name." "Yes," says the assistant chairman. "Yes," says Phaedrus omnisciently. "Aristotle." The assistant chairman is shocked for a moment, then, almost like a culprit who has been discovered but feels no guilt, laughs loud and long. "Oh, I see," he says. "You didn't know anything about..." Then he thinks better of what he is going to say and decides not to say anything more. We arrive at the turnoff to Crater Lake and go up a neat road into the national park, clean, tidy, and preserved. It really shouldn't be any other way, but this doesn't win any prizes for quality either. It turns it into a museum. This is how it was before the white man came. Beautiful lava flows and scrawny trees, and not a beer can anywhere. But now that the white man is here, it looks fake. Maybe the National Park Service should set just one pile of beer cans in the middle of all that lava, and then it would come to life. The absence of beer cans is distracting. At the lake, we stop and stretch and mingle affably with the small crowd of tourists holding cameras and children yelling, "Don't go too close!" and see cars and campers with all different license plates, and see the Crater Lake with a feeling of, well, there it is, just as the pictures show. I watch the other tourists, all of whom seem to have out-of-place looks, too. I have no resentment at all this, just a feeling that it's all unreal, and that the quality of the lake is smothered by the fact that it's so pointed to.
You point to something as having quality, and the quality tends to go away. Quality is what you see out of the corner of your eye. And so I look at the lake below, but feel the peculiar quality from the chill, almost frigid sunlight behind me, and the almost motionless wind.